Chapter 7. Monlow Harbour, Nerth, the evening of the day. Dinas Chain had been intent on scouring the palace for the author of the insolent, provocative note. He had not risen to its bait or allowed himself the distraction of anger, but it had usefully focused his mind. Chain held a frightening grip over his emotions, a skill he'd mastered between the ages of 12 and 13. He did not allow emotions to rule his behaviour, ever. Instead, he channeled them as fuel for his actions. He returned to the security post to review all the feeds from the palace's sensor lattice, but one of the adepts had brought him a coded message from the Lord Commander, summoning him with immediate effect. The Lord Commander was holding his first meeting with the Master of the Alpha Legion in his pavilion and wanted the Lucifer Black Bajalur to witness and observe the proceedings. "Have this run through full genic and biometric testing," he told the adept, handing him the note. "Report to me directly on my link. Misplace this evidence and I'll have you shot." The adept hurried off to do Chain's bidding, a sick and anxious expression on his face. Chain made his way to the pavilion, a vast edifice of void-shielded silk marquees. It had been erected on a low tell south of the palace precinct. The first streaks of evening were discolouring the sky, and the shadows had gone soft and long, as if they were melting. Thousands of filament lights in crystal shades had been strung like climbing ivy around the structure of the pavilion, and they twinkled in the dusk like the lights of a distant hive. They reminded Chain of the god walls of the Imperial Palace on Terra, the mountainside bastions and soaring ramparts illuminated by billions of slit windows, and the great beacons of light that sent vast beams of radiance into the top of the sky. That was a monument no man could see without experiencing an emotional response, not even Chain. In the older days, it was said that the antique Great Wall of Zhongor could be seen from near orbit. The Imperial Palace could be seen from Mars. Chain entered the pavilion via the security portal and submitted himself for checking and searches. On Samaranth, 2 years earlier, a security detail at the pavilion portal had waved him through, not wishing to interfere with a Lucifer Black. Chain had ordered the detail's immediate execution. A Lucifer Black uniform could be stolen or copied. No one could be given access to the Lord Commander until he had proved he was who he appeared to be. Chain paused briefly in one of the outer tents to converse with Ayman and Belloc, two of his most trusted Lucifers. He explained the business of the note to them and told them to return to the palace and continue the search. Their conversation to an outsider would have seemed odd. There was nothing convivial or comradely about it. Brief statements and instructions were exchanged or given. Lucifer Blacks related to one another in a dry, utilitarian shorthand, dealing only in facts. They expected one another to fill in any speculative blanks and make their own conjectures. Chain had already decided what the note meant, and was fully confident that Ayman and Belloc had grasped the implications too, from the bare facts he had relayed. As had been suspected, a process of espial was active at Monlow, within the weave of the Imperial fortifications. The spies were good, able, intelligent, and well-equipped. Their loyalties were unclear. Chain had suspected the Nerthine, but no Nerthine would have left a note in Low Gothic, unless the Imperials had massively underestimated the enemy's capacity for psychological warfare. The note meant many things, but most of all it meant overconfidence, and that was a fatal weakness in any person. A weakness of emotion. It was quite a feat to be able to sneak out from under the piercingly vigilant lattice of an Imperial security system, but it was altogether something else to acknowledge that you had been there, to leave a trace, a signature, a calling card. Why evade detection, seamlessly in this particular case, if you then admit that evasion by taking credit for it? Two motives occurred to Chain. Someone wanted to goad him and play games with him, or Someone was so sure of himself, the gamesmanship was part of the sport. Either way, overconfidence, a fatal flaw. The note itself, that little scrap of paper, would tell him everything he needed. The choice of language, the use of language, the phraseology, the psychology of meaning, the pen weight, the handwriting, the paper source, the type of stylus, the ink residue, the gene residue, the fibre trace, the note's position, the type and origin of the stone left to weigh it down. The spy, Chain's prey, had betrayed himself in 100 different ways, simply by being cocky. And that cockiness was the biggest lead of all. Chain removed his black helmet, slid it under his arm, and entered the main chamber of the glowing pavilion. Inside, lords of mankind were speaking with demigods.
"Khan, my love," the dragon crooned and licked his forehead with its red tongue.
John Grammaticus forced his way out of the dragon's biting jaws and woke up. Roxana smiled down at him, stroking his cheek.
"Damn, what time is it?" he asked.
"Night has fallen, Con. Lord Alpharius is dining in the pavilion tent with the Lord Commander."
Grammaticus sat up quickly, blinking.
"Damn, I have to go. I have to be there."
"Be here with me instead, Con."
"I wish I could."
He began to get dressed. She sat back, sullen and rebuffed. She glanced around.
"I think someone's been in here," Roxana observed.
"Yes, the gene whips," he said, nodding.
"Terra, what were they looking for?" she asked.
"Me," he smiled. A slow smile extended across Namit Jira's lips.
"I'm no expert," he said. "But you can't all be Alpharius."
Alpharius, or at least the giant who had presented himself as Alpharius to the Lord Commander at the great welcome, tipped back his head and laughed.
"Of course not, Lord. My legion is one body, and we share everything. Identity can be used as a weapon, so we turn one face against the enemy. However, we are friends here."
Surrounded by his lucifer-black companions, Namit Jira stood at one end of the tented chamber, the senior commanders of the expedition grouped around him in a crescent. The filament lamps covered the pavilion's ceiling like stars, and lumen banks underlit the tent walls. Striped and spotted animal pelts had been laid out across the floor as rugs, overlapping and luxurious. Serendip, Namit Jira's thylacine, had laid itself down on a speckled hide at the end of its slack gold lead. Facing them were four Astartes in purple plate. Foremost, Alpharius, his helmet still doffed, his copper skin lustrous in the golden light. The other three had joined him for the meeting, though no one, as Chain would later discover to his consternation, could say from where. Chain slipped in through a flap at the rear of the chamber, behind Namit Jira's entourage. Through a slit in the folds of the pavilion's walls, he could see gangs of liveried servants awaiting the order to hurry in with trays of sweetmeats, wine and fruit. Chamberlains were holding them at the ready.
"I am Alpharius," said the copper-skinned giant, repeating the pledge claim he had made at the great welcome. "I have brought with me Ingo Pech and Thias Herzog, my first and second captains."
Two of the Astartes behind him stepped forwards, removed their helmets with a click hiss of collar locks, and bowed. They were shaven-headed and copper-skinned too. A simple human glance would have read all three as identical triplets. Chain did not make a human glance. He appraised them quickly and efficiently. Not identical triplets, not non-identical triplets, or even uterine brothers. The immediate similarities were strong, but superficial. Alpharius was considerably taller than both of his captains.
What was more, there was an evident ethnic derivation in the build of his cranium, a slope of the forehead, a mass of the brow. Chain had been in the presence of Horus Lupercal, and he'd seen that distinctive physiognomy before. There was something about the eyes, too. Alfarius's eyes were cold blue, and shone with an arctic intelligence that made Chain shudder slightly. Of the other two, Herzog was ever so slightly the taller. Chain gauged their heights using the angles of the guy wires and sheet planes of the pavilion behind them. Herzog and Pech were not related either. Chain counted 18 points of dissimilarity between the comparative angles of their skulls, their eyes, their lips, the structure of their cheeks, the muscles of their necks, their noses, and, most especially, the fingerprint precise lobes of their ears. Herzog was older by 20 years. Pech was smaller, but stronger and smarter. There was a very slight but telling shadow around Herzog's scalp that suggested his hair was of a darker natural colour, and that he shaved his head to resemble his Primarch and his fellow captain. Herzog's eyes were blue, like his Primarch's, but Pech's were gold-flecked brown.
"Welcome, captains," Namatjira said.
The Astartes nodded.
"And the other?" Namatjira asked.
The fourth Astartes had remained at the back of the group, his helmet in place.
"That is one of my common troopers," Alfarius said. "He is simply here as an escort. His name is Omegon."
The warrior bowed without removing his helmet.
"The first lie," Chain thought. "Omegon is no common trooper."
Chain estimated Omegon's stature, once again using the geometries of the tent structure as a scale. The Astartes was at least as big as the Primarch himself.
"Who are you?" Chain wondered. "What are you pretending to be?"
"Let us talk of Nerth, my lord," said Pech, "and of how we finish this war."
Namatjira smiled.
"This compliance," he corrected.
"It is a war, sir," Pech replied, "as I'm sure the stalwart soldiers of the Imperial Army would attest. Let us not dress it up in political terms. Let us not skip over their sacrifices."
Major General Dev and Lord Wild of the Torrent coughed to suggest their gratitude at Pech's acknowledgement of their efforts. Some of their huskarls and high officers clacked their swords against their shields in approval. Namatjira snapped up a hand quickly for silence.
"Of course it's a war, sir," the Lord Commander said, acid in his tone. "Men die. My men die. But this is still an action of compliance. Or are you questioning the Emperor's design?"
Pech shook his head.
"No, Lord. I appreciate that the Emperor upholds a teleological scheme for the future of man, and I will endeavour to uphold it."
"He chases a utopian ideal," Herzog put in.
"He wishes to unify and perfect humanity through the intense application of martial violence," said Pech.
"We have no quarrel with that approach," said Herzog. "It is the only proven way man's destiny has ever been advanced."
"Even if utopian goals are ultimately counterintuitive to species survival," Pech added quickly. "Any political ambition that is inherently impossible to achieve is ultimately corrupting," said Herzog. "You cannot engender or force to be engendered a state of perfection," said Pech. "That line of action leads only to disaster, because perfection is an absolute that cannot be attained by an imperfect species."
"Utopia is a dangerous myth," said Herzog, "and only a fool would chase it."
"It is better to manage and maintain the flaws of man on an ongoing basis," said Pech.
"We say this only to recognize the blood debt of the Imperial Army that suffers and dies resolutely in the pursuit of that goal," said Herzog.
There was a long silence. Just as the blades began to batter the shields again, Alfarius said,
"I encourage my men to explore the philosophy of bloodshed, Lord.
I like them to understand the intellectual structure that informs their killing. The Emperor, my love and my life, seeks to set mankind in place as the uppermost species of the galaxy. I will not dispute that ambition. Neither will my captains. We simply recognize the Procrustean methods with which he enforces that dream. A utopian ideal is a fine thing to chase and to measure one's achievements against, but it cannot, ultimately, be achieved.
Are you suggesting the Emperor's design is wrong? Namatjira asked.
Not in the slightest, replied Alpharius.
My Lord Alpharius, said Lord Wilde in his piercing, blade-keen voice, how do we combat the Nerthine magic?
My Lord Wilde, said Alpharius, we don't. We extinguish it. The trays of food were heavy. There was no telling how much longer they'd be forced to stand there in the tented wings of the main pavilion space. The worst of it was, he simply couldn't hear. The voices in the main tent were muffled. Grammaticus realized he should have brought a listening aid. He thought he'd be close enough to hear the proceedings for himself. He needed a revised plan quickly, or the significant risk he was taking would be for nothing.
Sir,
he whispered. One of the chamberlains came down the line to him. What's the matter, boy? The chamberlain asked. Some of the other platter-laden servants in the line looked around.
How much longer, sir? Grammaticus asked.
As long as it damn well takes, the chamberlain replied.
Sir, said Grammaticus, this sauce is curdling. It needs to be set on the heat again, or it will spoil. I dare not for my life serve bad food to the Lord Commander and his guests.
The liveried chamberlain nodded.
Back to the kitchens with it. Be quick. They'll be calling for us soon.
Yes, sir,
said Grammaticus, and left the line, running with his platter towards the back flap of the tent service entrance. Outside, in the dark, he paused and dumped the platter and its contents into a spoil bin. No one noticed him. Outremar guards were distantly patrolling the edge of the pavilion's perimeter. He slipped into the dark blue shadows of the desert night. Grammaticus pulled off the servant's tabard and discarded it. He hadn't disguised himself as one of the feast servants in any detailed way, trusting his logokine to get him by. But knowing he would be under scrutiny for several minutes, he had stolen a tabard to wear over his tight, armoured body glove to reinforce his logokine disguise. He took a pair of low-light goggles from his thigh pouch and put them on. The world around him was instantly rendered in fuzzy, caustic shades of red and ochre light. He read the rows of taut cables that stretched from the side of the pavilion like millipede legs, anchoring it to the ground. Between these physical lines, he made out the web of intangible ones, the sensor beams and harmonic tripwires that protected the skirts of the great tent. Invisible to the naked eye, these thin beams would set off a multitude of alarms if tripped. Grammaticus adjusted his goggles to pick them up, tuning them to a harmonic value he'd cribbed from Ruxana's codebook without her knowledge or permission. He skirted forwards along the flank of the pavilion, looking for another way in, ducking under and stepping over the rigid cables and the ghost beams alike. In several places he had to stoop or even crawl to avoid breaking the luminous strands. Most projected diagonally down from small emitters attached to the lip of the tent's roof, but others followed the ground or ran parallel to the pavilion, snaking between emitters spiked in the sand. The goggles guided him. This endeavour was a great deal more demanding than evading the field security lattice on the kitchen block roof. The beams were active and live. Three times he froze, realizing he was about to interrupt a beam with a leg or a shoulder. There was no obvious vent or egress. Grammaticus found an open spot and knelt down.
He put his ear against the skin of the tent, using its taut acoustics to bring the voices inside to him. He could hear voices in conference. Lord Namatjira's tone was easy to detect, as was Lord Wilde's. Grammaticus identified the voice that had to belong to Alpharius and listened to the way it sounded for the first time. There was a quality to it that was quite distinctive. They were talking about the Nerthine magic and how to combat it. It both amused and distressed Grammaticus to hear the condescension in the Primarch's tone as he explained the notion of chaos to the Lord Commander and his retinue. What he was saying was such an oversimplification. The Alpha Legion barely understood the nature of chaos, yet here was its leader, presuming to teach even less well-informed souls about it. The Alpha Legion were the ones who had to learn, and soon. Grammaticus was concentrating so hard on listening that he detected the Lucifer Black behind him with only seconds to spare. Grammaticus stood up and turned. The Lucifer, who had come up behind him quite silently, was raising his sabre to strike. "Fool!" Grammaticus hissed. "It's me!" The Lucifer stopped in his tracks and quickly lowered his sword. "Chain?" he asked. "Sir?" "Yes," Grammaticus snapped. "Return to your patrol." Chain. Grammaticus logged the name in his memory for future reference. "Apologies," the Lucifer replied. "I obey." The Lucifer turned to melt away into the night. He hesitated. Shit, thought Grammaticus. His Logokine skills had wrong-footed the Lucifer Black for a moment, but only a moment. Clearly, the elite companions possessed iron-willed, unsuggestible minds. The Lucifer had already questioned the encounter and realized he had been tricked. The Lucifer Black was armored. Grammaticus was not. Grammaticus couldn't count on landing a clean, quick kill blow, nor could he risk using his digital ring weapon. The energy flare would set off every alarm within 10 meters. As the Lucifer turned back, Grammaticus threw a wolfpaw jab that crushed the vox hub bulge on the side of the Lucifer's jet-black helmet, preventing him from signalling an alert. The Lucifer began to shout, but his voice was muffled by the helmet's padded snout. Grammaticus rammed another jab in under the chin of the helm and crushed the man's larynx, rendering him mute. Grammaticus briefly hoped that the larynx punch might also prove to be a killing strike, but the Lucifer was made of stronger stuff. His sabre was still drawn, and he slashed at Grammaticus. Grammaticus blocked the blade with the adamantium strips woven into the forearm sleeves of his body glove and drove the palm of his right hand flat into the Lucifer's breastplate, a tension-reflexive strike that the Eldar called the Ilthred Take, or breathless touch. The Lucifer lurched, his breastplate cracking. As he stumbled backwards, Grammaticus looped his left hand around the Lucifer's right wrist and whip-snapped it, forcing the sabre out of the man's grip. It landed on the sand, a bare centimetre short of one of the ground-level sensor beams. The Lucifer was not yet done. Grammaticus had been forced to close tightly, and the Lucifer head-butted him. Grammaticus lurched backwards, pain engulfing the centre of his face as the helm crunched into him. He staggered and barely avoided an overhead beam. The Lucifer fumbled and drew his sidearm, his broken right wrist forcing him to use his left hand across his body. As soon as the las pistol came clear of its holster, Grammaticus threw a spin kick that sent it skidding away into the night beyond the tent. He flinched as the tumbling weapon passed between two strands of the invisible security web. This had to end, fast, before something got tripped. They were so tightly boxed in, it was like fighting inside a spider's web, and any wrong move would bring the spider pouncing down on them. The Lucifer threw a steel-shod fist at Grammaticus, who ducked left and chopped a passing body blow into the Lucifer's ribs. Grammaticus's hands, trained and subcutaneously strengthened though they were already sore and bloody from punching armor. Grammaticus tried to get behind the Lucifer, but the Lucifer caught him and clenched him in a chokehold. It would have finished the fight, except that the Lucifer was struggling with just one working hand. Grammaticus grunted and corded his neck muscles to ward against the Lucifer's choke.
Training and experience told him there was one clean way out of the hold, a body throw that would hurl his opponent up and over him. But his goggles saw a sensor beam running right in front of them. If he threw the Lucifer, his opponent's body would land across the beam. He kicked back hard instead, and the back of the Lucifer's head struck against one of the taut diagonal guy wires of the pavilion. The impact snapped the Lucifer's head forward, and he involuntarily butted the back of Grammaticus's skull. Grammaticus winced, but the chokehold broke. He swung around, dazed by the blow, and shot out a straight-fingered jab. The middle and index fingers of John Grammaticus's right hand punched through the left lens of the Lucifer's helmet and popped the eye behind it. The Lucifer, gurgling through his useless throat, fell backwards against the tent side and slid down in a heap. Grammaticus paused, crouching low, ready to sprint away if the impact raised an alarm. No alarm came. Grammaticus began to straighten up. The Lucifer flopped forwards, matter dripping like glue from his ruptured eye socket, and began to crawl across the sand. Grammaticus realized the Lucifer was dragging himself towards one of the ground-level beams, his armored hand clawing out to break it. He threw himself onto the Lucifer's back, grappling with him, trying to pull the arm back. The Lucifer was monstrously strong. He dragged Grammaticus with him as he crawled across the sand, straining to reach the harmonic tripwire. Vicing an elbow around the reaching, straining arm of the man underneath him, forcing it to pull short, Grammaticus drove another jab into the man's spine. Something cracked. Still, the Lucifer heaved himself forwards 10 centimetres from the beam. 5, the outstretched fingers shaking as they groped for the invisible cord. Grammaticus saw the Lucifer's discarded sabre lying on the sand beside them. He grabbed it, simultaneously wrenching the man's reaching arm back and up with all of his strength. He hacked with the sabre and took the Lucifer's limb off mid-forearm. The Lucifer convulsed under him. He reached out towards the beam with his stump, but he was well short of touching it. Grammaticus hastily clamped his left palm around the severed stump and compressed to stop the jetting arterial spray from hitting the beam and accomplishing what the Lucifer's outstretched hand had not. The armored body under him went into spasm. Grammaticus pinned it down with his legs and kept the stump clenched tight. He felt the hot blood surging against his palm. "I'm sorry," he whispered. The Lucifer trembled. Grammaticus put the tip of the sabre against the nape of his neck in the tiny gap between helmet lip and collar armour, and pushed. The blade slid clean through the neck and bit deep into the sand beneath. The Lucifer went still. Grammaticus waited until the pressure pulse against his palm finally ebbed away, and then let go of the stump. The truncated arm flopped onto the sand. Grammaticus rose to his feet. The stench of blood in the night air was overpowering. Some of it, a little of it, was his own. His fists were swollen and mangled. Blood seeped from his battered face, and pain made him see double. His skull throbbed from the blows it had taken. He was sure his nose was broken. He tried to steady himself. He felt sick. There was no chance of him continuing with his surveillance now. The Lucifer would be missed soon enough. Grammaticus had to get away. Fast. He moved away from the body, stepping over the tracery of sensor beams his goggles revealed, and stumbled away into the desert and the enfolding night. Dinas Chain paused. Alfarius was busy talking to Namatjira and the assembled lords about warding countermeasures. Chain wasn't listening anymore. A signal light was flashing on the jet black cuff of his suit. He slipped back behind the gathering and made his exit through the service tent. Outside, under the nerfine stars, he put his helmet back on and triggered the vox. "Chain, you signaled?" "Vital trace from Zadus lost. Report his last position."
West side of the pavilion, 20 meters north of the west porch. Route two men to that position, from the reserve, not the one stationed with the Lord Commander. I obey.
Chain moved off down the west side of the huge pavilion, carefully stepping over and around the light beams his visor showed to him. He drew his saber.
Trouble? A voice asked from behind him.
Chain whirled. The tip of his blade made a tiny ching as it grazed against the chest plate of the Astartes, who had appeared miraculously behind him. The huge armored warrior looked down at the saber tip pressing against his chest armor.
Nice, he said. Very quick. Dinas Chain, isn't it?
You know me? Chain asked.
The Legion likes to know everyone.
You're Omegon.
The Alpha chuckled, his laughter carried oddly by his helmet speaker.
You're good, Dinas Chain. We heard this about you. Yes, I'm Omegon. I saw you leave the tent in a hurry.
You saw me?
I was watching you. You. You were watching me. Don't pretend you weren't now.
I won't.
We love the same things, I think, Dinas.
Such as?
Caution. Secrecy. Stealth.
How do you know my name? Chain asked. The names of the Lucifers are never published.
Oh, come on, Dinas. Do we look like amateurs to you?
No.
You can put that away, I think, said Omegon.
Chain withdrew his saber. The tip had actually buried itself in the Astartes' chestplate, and it took a tug to remove it.
Any other man I'd have killed for less, said Omegon, looking down at the dent. And by the way, that's all you get.
Chain shrugged.
Why did you leave the pavilion in such a hurry?
One of my men is down.
Let's see, shall we?
The Alpha Legionnaire led the way. Chain realized with alarm that the Astartes was cheerfully striding through the serried sensor beams, breaking them without setting any of them off. Chain followed, hopping and stepping over the harmonic tags.
Something on your mind? Omegon called over his shoulder.
You are invisible to our security lattice, Chain replied.
Like I said, Dinas, do we look like amateurs to you?
He paused. Two men were approaching, the two Lucifers Chain had sent for. Chain raised a hand to indicate they should stay back. Omegon crouched down.
Is this your man? He asked.
Zadus lay face down beside the tent wall in a patch of bloodstained sand. His left arm had been severed above the wrist, and he had been pinned to the ground with his own sword. The hilt of it was almost flat to the nape of Zadus's neck.
Yes, said Chain.
He bent down beside the Astartes.
Quite a fight, said Omegon, pointing idly. His assailant crippled his vox to mute him. Right wrist is snapped. Probably a disarming move.
Omegon wrenched the saber out and rolled the corpse.
Muted him, too. Larynx punch. The eye's gone as well. Spine snapped between the third and fourth vertebrae. See? Someone did a good job here.
Chain nodded. Zadus had been one of his best.
I thought you Lucifers were meant to be tough.
Chain bridled. The Astartes laughed.
Relax. I know you're tough. I just meant whoever did this, he did it with his bare hands.
What?
That blood there on the vox bulge, that's the assailant's. He crushed it with his fist.
You can read that?
Rudimentary typing via optics. Yes, I can read that.
We should take a sample for proper genic analysis, but on first look I'd say your man was taken out by an unarmored human.
Chain straightened up. Tell me, Dinas, said Omegon, looking up at him. Who do you know that could do a thing like that?
No one, Chain replied.
His reply was honest, but he had his suspicions. All along the earthwork of the imperial fortifications, huge watchfires crackled and a million campfires twinkled between them. Overhead, a cloud-scudded night sky turned slowly retrograde. The night air was hot. Around their campfire, under their lank banner, the Carnivales were laughing and passing the bottle.
So, Lon made it? Cato Pius asked.
Peto Sonica took a swig from the bottle that came by and nodded.
He did, like I said.
Good old Lon, laughed Tink, one of Pius's bashaws. Nothing'll ever kill Lon.
Sonica nodded, took another pull from the bottle and handed it on. Behind him, somewhere, men were playing loud ganawa on hand drums and gimbris. Someone had thrown incense flakes into the campfires and sweetened the smoke.
Ah, but it's good to see you, Peto, Pius said, taking a swig of liquor and then belching triumphantly.
You too, Kay, Sonica laughed.
What will you do? Asked Bashaw Jens.
Sonica shrugged.
I don't know. Find another outfit that can use a few officers. I'm not worried about myself. I just want to make sure Lon and the others get placed all right.
Room for you all here, said Pius.
Sonica shook his head.
No room for two hets like me and you in this outfit, Kay, he chuckled. We'd end up fighting to the death.
Maybe, admitted Cato Pius.
You know it.
Maybe.
You know it, Kay. Terra, you're a good friend and generous to a fault. I thank you for that. But I'm going to hold out. Maybe rebuild the company. Maybe petition the Uxors for a new one. Fug, what is this we're drinking?
Jens's home brew, Pius replied, regarding the bottle he was clutching groggily. It's basically pure alcohol.
With a secret mix of herbs and spices, Jens added. My Jean Dar's special recipe.
Your Jean Dar clearly had sanity issues, Sonica told him. Pius snorted.
I've been meaning to catch up with Hurt, said Sonica. I haven't seen him since I got here. He's around, right? The Jokers are here.
Pius nodded.
Yes, Bronze is here.
The Jokers are camped at Line 10 South, I think, said one of the Bashaws.
What about Dimi Shiban? Sonica asked, trying to make the question sound natural.
You seen him?
No one had. Despite the liquor in his system and the blazing fires, Sonica felt cold.
Well, my friends, he said, getting to his feet unsteadily, I have to drain now. Secret mix or no secret mix.
Pius and his men laughed and booed Sonica as he meandered away from the campfires in search of the latrine trench. The raucous Maghribi rhythms of the Ganawa fell away behind him, and the hot, scented smoke thinned into cold, spare desert air.
That's Sonica, said Roke, passing the night vision scope to Boone.
Boone took a look for himself, training the scope down the embankment towards the field of campfires.
Yup, so he's hanging out with Pius, is he?
He's got no one else to hang out with, said Roke sourly. All of his dancers are bones in the desert.
We should have ourselves a word with Peto Sonica, I think, said Boone.
Why? Roke asked. We're watching Pius, aren't we? Pius is the one you've got the twitch about.
Boone shrugged.
I know, but Sonica was acting real funny last time I saw him, and now he turns up here breaking bread with the very man we're watching. I got a twitch all right, Roke. Come on.
Boone signalled to Farron, and the three Jean Whips moved off quietly down the slope. Sonica stood on the clapboards over the latrine pit, undoing his fly with his one good hand, wrinkling his nose at the rising stink of ammonia. He swayed as he urinated. Behind him, the Carnivales huddled around the crackling fires, laughing and shouting. Amber smoke hazed up into the soft darkness of the backward sky. Something made Sonica look around.
He buttoned up quickly, dearly wishing he could clear his swimming head. A man was walking towards him along the edge of the latrine gutter, a silhouette backlit by the dancing campfires of the billet behind them.
"Who's that?" Sonica called out. "Who is that?"
He hoped Cado would hear him, but the men around the campfires were making too much noise.
"How's it going, Sonica?" the man asked.
The man was in shadow, but his teeth glinted in the distant firelight as he smiled. Sonica knew him. Farron, one of the Gene Whip's bulls.
"I'm fine," said Sonica.
He turned to walk away in the opposite direction and found Roke blocking his path.
"What is this?" Sonica asked,
though he was sure he knew all too well. He began to sober up very quickly.
"You and Pius, you're tight?" asked Roke.
"Of course," said Sonica warily.
"We've known each other a long time."
"You know him well, then?"
"Yes," said Sonica.
The line of questioning was not going where he had expected it would. He braced himself for whatever verbal trap they were trying to lead him into.
"So you know about him and Uxor Ruxartna, then?" asked Farron.
"What about them?" "You know," Roke leered.
"Kay and Ruxana?"
That almost made Sonica laugh. "You've got that wrong. If they were carrying on, we'd all know about it."
"Why?" asked Roke.
Because if Cado Pius had nailed a piece of ass that fine, he'd be bragging about it to everyone.
"Maybe Cado Pius isn't who he seems," Farron said, coming in closer behind Sonica. "We met Cado Pius earlier today, at least we think we did."
"I don't know what you're talking about," said Sonica. "Have you boys been at the homebrew tonight?"
"What's going on with Pius?"
Roke asked, unamused.
"What's he into?" asked Farron. "You know him. What's he got involved in? Are you involved too? Is that why you're being so evasive?"
I'm not."
"What's the story, Sonica? How come you survive visages when every other bastard there got cut to ribbons? Someone looking out for you? Someone tip you off?"
"Listen, you," Sonica began.
"What's all this stuff about a body?" Roke asked.
Sonica sank his shoulders as if about to cave and confess to something. As Roke leaned in, Sonica caught him by the arm and pushed him into the latrine pit. There was a splash, followed by furious, spluttered curses. Farron lunged at Sonica and took Sonica's left elbow in the teeth for his trouble. Sonica began to run. Farron came after him, hurling as much abuse as his floundering partner down in the pit. Sonica scrambled up the embankment in the dark and found the billet road. Torch beams chased him.
"Stay right there, Sonica," a voice called out.
Sonica knew it. Gene Whip Boone. He started to run away from the beams and heard the crack of a las pistol. A bright puff of dust lit up the ground near his feet.
"Next one goes in your head, Sonica," Boone yelled. "Stay right where you are."
Sonica didn't slow down. He sprinted along the billet road looking for cover. Blazing light suddenly came on and blinded him. He skidded to a halt, shielding his eyes against the glare. He heard the rumble of a turbine engine. A door opened.
"Get in," a voice yelled.
Sonica blinked. Behind the headlights he saw Bronzy, glaring at him from behind the wheel of a battered staff speeder.
"Just get in, pedo," Bronzo repeated. "For fuck's sake."
Sonica got in, and the speeder ripped away into the darkness, leaving the pursuing Gene Whips far behind.